The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today is Peter Himmelman. Peter is a singer and songwriter originally from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. In addition to a number of fantastic albums, Peter has composed for television and film, and he is the founder of Big Muse, a company that helps both individuals and businesses unlock their creative potential. Peter is a graduate of the Kellogg School of Business's Advanced Management Program. Peter, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Hey, thank you, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here.
So one of my favorite improv phrases is start in the middle, so I'm going to do that. I was reading some of your blog posts, and I came across this quote from you. You say, "To my mind, a sense of discontentment is the thing that drives human initiative and innovation. It's the thing that says the world is imperfect, and we must get up off our asses and do something about it." So it seems to me that you're talking about the need for individuals to use their fears and their worries rather than to be laid inert by them.
Well, look, this is from someone who has been laid inert by that for many occasions, so I know from what I speak. I guess I'm trying to create some utility by the way things, you know, really are. And
so,
some people say to me, well, you seem to have things, you know, so, well, balancing all these things. Nothing I do is balanced. I don't believe in balance.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe in self-discipline either, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Only because those things are so hard to achieve and they're so unreliable. For me, trying to create some utility out of, I guess, that discontent, I don't remember that quote exactly, but I do agree with the man who wrote it entirely.
Yeah.
You know, those things are as native to us and as abundant to us as times that go well. So why neglect half of our lives, basically?
Well, absolutely. So what I find so interesting about that is in improvisation, you are taught to accept everything as a gift. So the idea here is if you see something that's in front of you, see it as a gift rather than an obstacle, because that will change the way you exist in the world. And it doesn't always mean that the scene will go great. It just means that you're going to be in the scene. And I love that as a metaphor, right, for what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's kind of beautiful. I mean, I take these things to wild extremes, and it makes me think of, there's a certain idea from Jewish thought that the roots of idol worship are not exactly that you have to bow down to a stone idol, but every time you grouse something isn't going your way, you somehow think that you know more about the grand plan than the designer somehow.
Right.
And people always say, in a perfect world, so-and-so. I always, you know, Jeff corrected, this is a perfect world. There is none other.
Mm-hmm. And there's an aspect, too, about that I think relates to mindfulness. And very practical mindfulness, right? Group mindfulness, when you allow all the things to be that are, and rather than worrying about what came before, what came after, you're staying present and just dealing with what's there. And I love this idea of utility because I do think it relates to faith. Not something that, you know, in the Catholicism I was brought up ever seemed practical to me. But you know, as I've grown older and met wise people, they seem to live in that place where you know, their faith can you know, also operate in a place that's very vital and utile in the world that they're living in.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. And in terms of mindfulness, and some of these words become tropes somehow, and
yep.
forget what they mean. As a kid, I used to sit there and say the word rope, over and over until it had no meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sort of rediscover what that means. I found even the word creativity, which, you know, I tend to use because it's a good marketing word,
yep.
it's something that I find myself taking a lot of time exploding the word.
Yeah.
Redefining it for myself and others.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things we've talked about on this program a lot with people is that the American media and others have made creativity seem like the province of a select few. And we spend a lot of time debunking that here, which is everyone has creativity in their life, and many just need to unlock their creative behaviors. It's
yeah,
not something
I mean,
special.
That's sort of become, I don't know, maybe it's for myself or for others. It's become the theme of a lot of my conversations. A lot of people that I work with, you mentioned, you know, at organizations and so on, and just normal interactions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do a lot of things, and you're such a creative person, and, you know, little do they know, those things that I'm doing could just be manifestations of habits, of,
right.
you know, the opposite of creative. And what I'm trying to say is creativity isn't mastery. What we admire so often is mastery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the skill of some incredible pianist, and we declare that pianist creative, whereas the actuary who deals on an unbelievable sort of fecund, imaginative level with his, say, his clients and his family, we deem him, because of his job title, an uncreative person.
Right.
To me, creativity is what naturally occurs when we're not afraid.
Mm-hmm.
We're responsive, we're then naturally mindful, we're open to what's going on, and then our mastery and our skill sets can sort of, we can bring them to the fore unencumbered by this fear.
Yeah, and that also is something I think why it's so important in certainly the study of improvisation, and I think what you do as well, the importance of play. And I found this Martin Buber quote, which was, "Play is the exaltation of the possible." And it strikes me that a lot of the issues that people have around tapping into creativity as adults, it's anathema to children, because mostly they're in a near constant state of play, and it's wonderful. But as adults, we get that driven out of us.
Yeah, I mean, it depends too. Some children, and I suspect being sort of over inundated with the offerings of media,
mm-hmm.
they begin to take this descent into judgment earlier than you would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And really what prevents play, again, is the fear, and the fear is a fear of judgment.
Right.
I'm going to be caught doing something, you know, the chain of sort of that I set up in my mind is something I talk about, this character that I created called Marv,
mm-hmm.
who's just this sort of milquetoasty guy in our head. Maybe he lives in our limbic brain. And Marv is the voice of fear, the one that we all know so well. And my kind of thought or philosophy on it is we don't want to banish this voice. We don't want to, you know, terrorize it. He's basically just trying to help.
Right.
And if a, you know, rabid puma were to pounce into the room, Marv would probably be the one to save us if there was a chance of saving us. He's saying, you know, Peter, if you do this thing, you talk to, you know, Kelly, he's so intelligent, you come off sounding like an idiot, you'll fail. You will have failed. And, you know, there's a chance that that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
He presents with a, you know, a real scenario, even if the proportions are not exact. If you fail, he says, you will be ashamed.
Yeah.
True. And shameful people, the consequence of being a shameful person is that you are abandoned.
Yeah.
And then he brings us back to a time pre-verbal, perhaps, where abandonment truly meant our own demise. It meant that we would die.
Right.
So when people are afraid to do things, maybe to improvise or, as you say, to play, like Martin Buber would suggest, they're really in some ways evincing a mortal fear.
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting. I'm not a science guy, but I've been fascinated by some of the neuroscience I've read. And there was a study a couple years ago with freestyle rappers, and they were measuring their brains when they were improvising their rap lyrics and when they weren't. And when they were improvising their rap lyrics, the part of the brain that self-judges goes way down. And this may seem obvious, but
it was beautiful. It was in an MRI.
You
literally could see it.
You could physically see it. And, you know, and that's such a thing of beauty. And it's certainly something we see in our work because, you know, we teach people at Second City, we teach kids, right, to do this work. Actually, they are easier. It's when the adults come in, especially the beginning adults in improvisation, that you're spending all the early classes. You could use this term. You're getting them out of their head. That's not entirely true because you want them to be in their head, but free of the judgment. And
you know, it's funny when you mention that because I took your course through the Illinois Institute of Technology. I did a summer session with those guys.
Yeah.
And I found a problem that I see often, that people who define themselves as creative types, you know, such as myself, are sometimes really fearful of judgment in creative situations. So
right.
if somebody who sells insurance and he looks at your offerings at Second City is just, this is a marvelous experience.
Right.
He doesn't enter it with the same judgment that I do. And I remember thinking, if I get up there and do something, it damn well better be good.
Right.
Because I'm defining myself as superior at delivering these, quote, creative ideas. You know, so I do find that even among designers and poets and artists, at least initially, there is that reluctance and that sense of judgment. And you just simply move people through that. But it may take a while, and it may be something that people would think is sort of paradoxical.
Yeah, and you're 100% right. In two examples of that, the wonderful British actor Jonathan Pryce, who was in Brazil and so many other great films, he came to Second City one evening, and we asked him, as we do many celebrities, especially actors, do you want to improvise as part of the improv set? And we'll take care of you, don't worry. And he did it, and he did great. We went to a bar afterwards. He was literally shaking. And confess, he goes, I've never been that frightened. I don't even know. I mean, like,
I totally get it.
Yeah, he had to leave. Yeah, it's and I do think it's that pressure, especially a craftsman, you know, like yourself and like Jonathan Pryce. There is an expectation. These people don't know that he's not an improviser. There's anything different than that. He's getting up on stage to show off. And then suddenly he could be revealed as not being skilled, you know, as if, right, all of us have to be working at 100%, you know, throughout the entire day.
And I wonder if he was reflecting back on it was more frightening for him than it was in the actual doing.
Sure.
Because you said he was really good.
He was good. No, it was. It was after. And the other story I have of that, because it never happened, was Sir John Gielgud attempting to improvise. No, I've actually got it wrong. It was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore were in Toronto with the SCTV cast. For those of you who don't know that legendary show, it had people like John Candy and Martin Short and Andrea Martin and Catherine O'Hara, just wonderful ensemble. Well, they got so plowed they actually couldn't improvise and did it on purpose because they were just so fearful of doing it.
Set up a roadblock for themselves.
And and Cook and Moore, this is like the most legendary sort of comic performers. And what's interesting about that too, and I think it ties in perhaps because, you know, you're working with businesses right now and you're an artist. You're a really, really wonderful songwriter who is working with these businesses. And I'm curious about, you know, one of the things that we hear a lot from businesses is the need and want for their brand to be authentic. And again, this is going to be one of those rope words for you, I think. But I am curious whether that comes up with you in terms of the search for what is authentic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a word that I use. I mean, it's something I might use in my marketing. It's something that mm-hmm. people ask of me to help out of their people. So we kind of know what it is. I mean, authentic simply means, for the moment, having no fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there isn't anyone in the world that can eliminate your fear. That is ridiculous. And, you know,
right.
You can reduce it, techniques to reduce it momentarily, maybe an hour or two at a time, which can be very productive. You can get so much done in an hour or two. But in that sort of fearless moment, talking to your children or even your spouse, there's sometimes a lot of fear talking to people that you love.
Right.
You know. But in those moments of fearlessness, you reveal yourself. And the funny thing is about that, it's beautiful, is revealing yourself to yourself.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I'm writing a song, let me start over. Whenever a song is really good, it comes out and it's really good, it's nothing I ever planned. It's nothing I ever would have thought of, could have conceived. And it is this revelation of self to self that's so, you can get goosebumps even just thinking
yeah.
about it. Those times in all our lives where we've, look, here's the thing. The greatest, most beautiful thing, the most wondrous thing of all, which we can never quite see, is that we're actually alive on the surface of a planet.
Yeah.
And that is this incredible contradiction that we are these, whatever you'd like to call them, spiritual beings encased in this meat sack, and we walk and gravity holds us down and there's a sun shining.
Mm-hmm.
If only we could wake up, we would weep with awe and joy.
Yes.
I mean, basically at every moment. This is part of the authenticity that can once in a while leach through the soil and kind of leak through. And we become aware, not of something strange, but of something unbelievably familiar.
Right. And I think for businesses, the idea, the leap that we have to help them make, business people working in businesses, I should say, is that if they're truly looking for authenticity, it's going to require vulnerability. And that's not comfortable. But it's this discomfort, you know, that we sort of referred to earlier where, you know, and we said discontentment, but it's discomfort as well that drives a lot of power. And you know, Kurt Vonnegut is quoted as saying the act of writing is discovery. And that I know that's true in our work, that the very best material was just created and was not planned for. And we have to allow for those moments to exist, right? So businesses come to you and they come to us because they see a problem that their people aren't being creative, or they're for some reason innovation isn't happening. And I think what we sort of collectively say is, okay, it's not just, you can't just point to someone and say be creative. You have to create space for them to create. Then there's stuff to do on the person as well, but you really have to have an environment in which they can make these discoveries.
Oftentimes when leaders come to me and they, you know, they have it asked, we'd like our people to become, you know, more innovative, more creative, whatever that means, sort of mm-hmm. produce more original ideas. You know, how are you helping that?
Right.
And perhaps in many cases, what are you doing to stymie those efforts?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of nurturance are you providing? What is your risk aversion?
Right.
Because in that ask, you're going to get a lot of ideas that aren't going to pay off.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happens is originally somebody comes up with some impetus, some creative idea, this embryo, and then you start repeating it. You want to do it more and more. And then you become habituated to doing that one thing. And it's just the weird paradox. I don't know why this is, but habits just kill creativity.
Right.
But habits are good sometimes for short-term sort of cost-effectiveness.
Yeah.
and people wrestle with that. If you truly want people to be more creative, you're going to have to look a little bit longer out on the horizon. You're going to have a little bit more stomach for people's iterations that may not pay off immediately.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's
99% the job of the leader to make sure that he or she themselves understands this condition.
Sure.
And is in that condition themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in sort of machinery, they talk about prototyping. And in this case, what you got to be able to let people prototype those ideas, which means let the bad ideas have to come out. That's part of it. And, you know, often through then you find the great stuff. There's one other thing that I thought was a very savvy sort of business idea that you came up with. And I'm going to quote you. You say, since both songwriters and salespeople will always have the challenge of capturing audiences with limited attention spans, they'll both need to come up with ideas that are singularly compelling. One phrase from the world of songwriting is to simply be mindful of cliches. So I think this is a huge point because, like, in our field, we talk about, you know, not wanting easy laughs. We don't want the easy laughs. And to your point, which I think is just really important, is just think about, is this a cliche? Because so much is, as we're walking around in this world, whether it's an advertising slogan or some push that someone's doing in the office to get people to work harder. These are cliches. They're not going to help.
I always ask songwriters, I mean, obviously the songwriting has perhaps at some level more emotionality or should than a business marketing plan, perhaps, mm-hmm. maybe not. I always ask them, you know, have you ever cried writing a song or deeply felt something?
Mm-hmm.
No one cries or deeply feels from some trope or some cliche. It just simply doesn't happen. I guess I'm referring in that piece that you quoted, like, here's one, just a very simple thing you can do. Just look at your thing and identify if you've had a cliche, that it's not right.
Yeah.
And know that when you have a cliche, you haven't been in the right mood for producing something.
Yeah.
But that's fine. You know, that's excellent that you're doing it. I'm in the middle of Adam Grant's Originals.
Right? Oh, I love that book.
Yeah, I love him and I love mm-hmm. the book. And, you know, one of the things, you know, I like reading about is things that, I must be an original. I do that.
Right.
Procrastinating, he says, is perfect for...
Oh, I've been using that one.
Activity. Yep. I'm always doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that he says is, it's really resonated with me. And, you know, again, I'm not a science guy, and mm-hmm. he is. He's an organizational psychologist. He's a professor. So everything's data-driven, and I guess you can rely on that. But people that produce original ideas and creative works, they almost always produce a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
And this is something that I tell, you know, songwriters, fledgling or anyone, you must constantly make things and you must become inured to things that are not, that don't necessarily win. And I'm looking for words because I'm constantly trying to winnow out the words failure and success from my vocabulary.
Sure.
I just don't like the terms for my life, and I'm trying to substitute them.
Yeah.
But what he's saying is that not only do these people who create this massive amount of work, whether it's business plans or marketing ideas or design ideas or music or poetry or dance, what they're doing isn't simply saying, well, I have a lot of, you know, things so I can pick out the best. That's, of course, true. The odds are greater. But even more importantly is that you're exploring pathways.
Yeah.
By making many iterations and sharing those iterations. And I'm fighting, there's a friend of mine who's a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he offers me this criticism, which I've always chafed against.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you put out so much stuff. You know, you should take much more time with it. And mm-hmm. I know for a fact that he's, you know, been working on something for 16 years or something.
Yeah.
He's never really made anything.
Right.
And I'm like, the discovery and the spare parts that you have around from all these attempts is just such a rich field.
Yeah. And one thing I've noticed in young performers,
comic performers, they get very fearful of giving up their character or their idea, you know, in fear that someone's going to steal it or own it. And my thing is, like, if you have one idea, you're done anyway, because it's just it ends right there. You know, the free marketplace of ideas, put it out, see what's going to happen. And if you have the talent, you're going to be able to see it through. And I've seen that for nearly three decades work at Second City. And one of the things I think about when we were talking about earlier about play, that play teaches you, is it allows you to model the resilience. And so in play, we are winning and losing, but those terms don't need to be pejorative, right? I mean, because there's no stakes there. We can win a game or lose a game, but it means nothing. Mm-hmm. But we get to experience that thing that you don't want to call failure and that thing you don't want to call success in a way that is unencumbered by the societal stuff. And this is the thing I think is so important about improvisation and about what you just talked about, which is, you know, put your stuff out there, put it up, play it, write it, give it to someone, because then the more you do that, the less precious you're going to be about it. And again, when you put your art out in the world, it could change the art and make it even more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you'll get feedback. Isn't that why we do anything? Isn't why we start businesses?
Get feedback.
We're entrepreneurs. We take on this burden of conjuring a nascent idea, pulling it through the ephemeral pinhole into the real world. That's artistry. We do this for some effect. If we're the only person on the face of the earth, I can guarantee you we wouldn't do any of it.
Yeah, we had on Neil Stevenson from the design firm IDEO, and he was talking about virtual reality and playing around with sort of Oculus Rift stuff. And he talked about a Paul McCartney concert that was done that he was given to enjoy by himself in this virtual world, and it was rubbish. And it ended up being rubbish not because the concert wasn't good, but because he couldn't share it with anyone.
Right.
And it completely changed the experience.
Well, you know, that brings up a whole idea about the way that we consume music these days. I mean, it's you can say many things about it, and just picking one, which made me think about, it's become such a solo experience with, you know, earbuds and so on.
Yeah.
The idea of, you know, taking home the new Neil Young record and, you know, you call a friend and you sit and listen to it together.
Right.
And there's a reason that music isn't selling. It's not only that you can get it for free. Nobody cares about the experience anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just wrote something today. I'm doing a Kickstarter campaign, my second in 3 years, and some fan described himself as a rabid fan, and he was very angry with this whole Kickstarter idea. And I sort of said, you know, not to invoke Prince at this time, but it'll illustrate something. As much as we admired Prince, he was, you know, arguably the best musician on the face of the earth.
Sure.
He died, and as much as we're sort of mourning his loss, I said, look, I'm going to ask a question. I know no one bought his last four albums. That's
right.
A given.
Mm-hmm.
But does anyone know even one name of one of his albums?
Right.
And the answer is basically no.
Mm-hmm.
And that really goes to show how far the whole thing has disappeared. And I would, as connecting to what you just said, part of the reason it's disappeared is it's no longer a shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't like things that are only on our own.
Right.
It's very masturbatory. It's less than satisfying.
Yeah.
We want to share our life experiences. We want to listen to music together.
Right.
And it's far more rewarding. And you know, putting your stuff out there means a response, and you learn from those responses.
Yeah, and I know some young artists and actually friends of mine who just left their label had kind of looked at their world and were like, you know what, we make all our money on the road. We love we sell out. They can sell out a 1,200, 1,300 seat arena, and they got rid of their middleman and they realized this is how we're going to make our living, and we're going to record our own music, but we're really going to be out there playing on the road. And I'm like, wow, it's just changed so much from the world I grew up in, which was run to that record store, get the new album. Everyone came over. You listened it together. You probably sorted your pot out on the fold. It was a real communal experience that really doesn't exist, anymore.
Yeah, and not to mention the idea, which you brought up about the pot and the fold, not so much the pot, but the fact that there was a fold.
Yeah.
This idea that when things are no longer things, that we can no longer grasp or touch or smell, they become these virtual items. And we have, by dint of our humanity, much less appreciation. We grant them much less value than we do things that we can actually touch.
Right.
And as music went from, first of all, it was always a non-spatial thing. Music is invisible waves, basically. And then it was briefly entombed in piano rolls and in 78s and 33s and 45 and on and on and on to all the delivery systems until now it's kind of reverted back to a non-thing.
Yeah.
And for a non-thing, it's very difficult to charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we were speaking to Howard Tolman, who is a very savvy tech guy who said, the worry he has for the next generation is because they don't seem to have any interest in owning things, they're not going to – not only are they not going to buy cars, they're not going to buy art. So the idea of buying a painting and having it on your wall or going to a museum to see a painting, he's worried will, drift away.
He should have been trying to get into the Broad last week. So
yeah,
there is hope.
Yeah, there is. Oh yeah, I was in L.A. a while back and could not get into there. So
well, I actually thought I did think of that. Like, this seems to be a healthy thing.
Yep.
You can't get in there. But yeah, it's something to think about. We forget so many times that we are, and this is. Plays back what you're talking about, what does authenticity mean and what does it mean to businesses? We forget that we're human beings. We laugh and we bleed and we taste food and we move. We're not just brains in saline solution.
Right.
And the products and services that people offer us somehow must relate to the totality of our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
They can't just reach one piece if they're going to really be successful.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very true. Okay, so I can't believe that these conversations go so quickly and they could go on forever. Two things. One, you have a book coming out in the fall, I see. It's called Let Me Out, Unlock Your Creative Mind and Bring Your Ideas to Life.
That's right.
One of the things that you talked about there in the book is one of the areas is finishing projects that have stayed in the bits and pieces phase forever. And I would imagine that alone, if you just use that as your marketing slogan, would sell tens of thousands of books.
I'll bring that up to those people.
Yeah. Move that one to number one, finishing projects that have stayed in bits and pieces, because I know you're speaking not only to me, but to everyone. And the way that we end the podcast each week is that we ask our guest to think of a time in their life where they applied yes and, where they could have said no, they could have said yes, but instead they said yes and. They affirmed and contributed, and it might have led them somewhere terrible. It also might have led them somewhere fascinating. I would imagine with you, Peter, that there's a lot of these to choose from, but I wonder if you've got one in your life that you could share with us right now.
Well, I was thinking of something that I'm trying to think of a specific incident. I use it a lot with my wife of 30 years.
Hmm.
And it's not just a ploy. You'll have to pardon me if there's not any total specificity, only that
no,
I use
okay.
it so often. So it's not a psychological trick.
Mm-hmm.
What it does for me is kind of create a space where I stop talking and I stop thinking about for a minute about my own needs. And as I open up that space and I say yes and, I'm really hearing her.
Yeah.
I'm really allowing her to not that she needs my permission, but, you know, two people to speak, you do need to give permission.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding out more about what it is she wants. In turn, you know, there's a greater mutuality born from this thing.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it strikes me too. I just celebrated my 20th anniversary. That the thing you need to pay fierce attention to in these deep relationships you have is because you become so familiar, is to recognize that there's still unfamiliar feelings, things not said, and you have to make space for that. And that's a huge yes and, because that's a yes and to something that's a little less tangible and easy.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, the idea that we think this person that we spent all this time with these decades is wholly known.
Yeah.
In fact, this person is 99.9% total mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great thought. Let's end on that. That's a very positive, good thought for someone out there, and certainly for us. Hey, Peter, thank you so much for joining us on Getting to Yes And. You've been listening to Second City Works' Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. You can find more information about Second City Works at secondcityworks.com. We'll see you next week.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.